This is The Guardian.
Hi, my name is Susie Hansen. I'm the author of Unlearning the Myth of American Innocence. This article was an excerpt from my first book, Notes on a Foreign Country, which I decided to write because I felt there hadn't been a book that showed a white American reckoning with her role in the world and with her country's historical imperial role in the world. To the extent that Americans had little to no idea, I thought, how American power had affected the lives of millions of people for the last 100 years. This meant too, of course, that they had no idea how that power had shaped and in many ways warped their own identities. It's interesting to me that since I published this, so much happened in the United States having to do with Black Lives Matter and Trump and everything that has gone on in the last years. And there's this idea that is much more popular now that white Americans have a lot of work to do on themselves. But one thing I am sometimes disappointed by is that we haven't really extended that conversation to the way white Americans relate to the rest of the world, to non-Americans. We haven't really addressed this need for a greater awareness of American empire and its effect on the American identity. So I'm still hopeful, though, that we'll get to that eventually. This piece is also about me being a journalist and being a foreign correspondent. And I think what surprised me is that no matter how much I learned about the history of American foreign policy in many of the countries that I was going to, I would continue to experience this history or this new knowledge that I was acquiring with a kind of surprise. I think that American innocence is so resilient, it's so deep within us, that it almost felt to me as if it was an impossible thing to conquer. And I think it's something that Americans have to be very, very conscious of, that American exceptionalism is so deeply ingrained in their minds that it's sometimes something that they're not even very aware of.
Welcome to The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism covering culture, politics, and new thinking. For the text version of this and all our long reads, go to theguardian.com/longread.
Unlearning the Myth of American Innocence. This article contains strong language. My mother recently found piles of my notebooks from when I was a small child that were filled with plans for my future. I was very ambitious. I wrote out what I would do at every age, when I would get married, and when I would have kids, and when I would open a dance studio. When I left my small hometown for college, this sort of planning stopped. The experience of going to a radically new place, as college was to me, upended my sense of the world and its possibilities. The same thing happened when I moved to New York after college, and a few years later, when I moved to Istanbul. All change is dramatic for provincial people, but the last move was the hardest. In Turkey, the upheaval was far more unsettling. After a while, I began to feel that the entire foundation of my consciousness was a lie. For all their patriotism, Americans rarely think about how their national identities relate to their personal ones. This indifference is particular to the psychology of white Americans and has a history unique to the U.S. In recent years, however, this national identity has become more difficult to ignore. Americans can no longer travel in foreign countries without noticing the strange weight we carry with us. In these years after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the many wars that followed, it has become more difficult to gallivant across the world absorbing its wisdom and resources for one's own personal use. Americans abroad now do not have the same swagger, the easy, enormous smiles. You no longer want to speak so loud. There is always the vague risk of breaking something. Some years after I moved to Istanbul, I bought a notebook. And unlike that confident child, I wrote down not plans, but a question. Who do we become if we don't become Americans? If we discover that our identity as we understood it had been a myth? I asked it because my years as an American abroad in the 21st century were not a joyous romp of self-discovery and romance. Mine were more of a shattering and a shame. And even now, I still don't know myself. I grew up in Wall, a town located by the Jersey Shore, 2 hours' drive from New York. Much of it was a landscape of concrete and parking lots, plastic signs and Dunkin' Donuts. There was no center, no main street, as there was in most of the pleasant beach towns nearby. No tiny old movie theater or architecture suggesting some sort of history or memory. Most of my friends' parents were teachers, nurses, cops, or electricians, except for the rare father who worked in the city, and a handful of Italian families who did less legal things. My parents were descendants of working-class Danish, Italian, and Irish immigrants who had little memory of their European origins, and my extended family ran an inexpensive public golf course where I worked as a hot dog girl in the summers. The politics I heard about as a kid had to do with taxes and immigrants and not much else. Bill Clinton was not popular in my house. In 2016, most of Wall voted Trump. We were all patriotic, but I can't even conceive of what else we could have been, because our entire experience was domestic, interior, American. We went to church on Sundays until church time was usurped by soccer games. I don't remember a strong sense of civic engagement. Instead, I had the feeling that people could take things from you if you didn't stay vigilant. Our goals remained local. Homecoming queen, state champs, a scholarship to Trenton State, barbecues in the backyard. The lone Asian kid in our class studied hard and went to Berkeley. The Indian went to Yale. Black people never came to Wall. The world was white, Christian. The world was us. We did not study world maps because international geography as a subject had been phased out of many state curriculums long before. There was no sense of the U.S. being one country on a planet of many countries. Even the Soviet Union seemed something more like the Death Star, flying overhead ready to laser us to smithereens, than a country with people in it. I have TV memories of world events. Even in my mind, they appear on a screen. Oliver North testifying in the Iran-Contra hearings. The scarred, evil-seeming face of Panama's dictator Manuel Noriega. The movie-like footage, all flashes of light, of the bombing of Baghdad during the first Gulf War. Mostly what I remember of that war in Iraq was singing God Bless the USA on the school bus. I was 13. And wearing little yellow ribbons and becoming teary-eyed as I remembered the video of the song I'd seen on MTV. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. That at least is funny. We were free. At the very least, we were that. Everyone else was a chump because they didn't even have that obvious thing. Whatever it meant, it was the thing that we had and no one else did. It was our God-given gift, our superpower. By the time I got to high school, I knew that communism had gone away, but never learned what communism had actually been. Bad was enough. Religion, politics, race, they washed over me like troubled things that obviously meant something to someone somewhere, but that had no relationship to me, to Wall, to America. I certainly had no idea that most people in the world felt those connections deeply. History, America's history, the world's history, would slip in and out of my consciousness with no resonance whatsoever. Racism, anti-Semitism, and prejudice, however, those things on some unconscious level I must have known. They were expressed in the fear of Asbury Park, which was black, in the resentment of the towns of Marlborough and Deal, which were known as Jewish, in the way Hispanics seemed exotic. much of the Jersey Shore was segregated as if it was still the 1950s, and so prejudice was expressed through fear of anything outside Wall, anything outside the tiny white world in which we lived. If there was something that saved us from being outwardly racist, it was that in small towns such as Wall, especially for girls, it was important to be nice or good. This pressure tempered tendencies toward overt cruelty when we were young. I was lucky that I had a mother who nourished my early-onset book addiction, an older brother with mysteriously acquired progressive politics, and a father who spent his evenings studying obscure golf antiques, lost in the pleasures of the past. In these days of the 1%, I'm nostalgic for Wall's middle-class modesty and its sea-salt Jersey Shore air. But as a teenager, I knew that the only thing that could rescue me from the wall of fear was a good college. I ended up at the University of Pennsylvania. The lack of interest in the wider world that I had known in Wall found another expression there, although at Penn the children were wealthy, highly educated, and apolitical. During orientation, the business school students were told that they were the smartest people in the country, or so I'd heard. Donald Trump Jr. was there then, too. In the late 1990s, everyone at Penn wanted to be an investment banker, and many would go on to help bring down the world economy a decade later. But they were more educated than I was. In American literature class, they'd even heard of William Faulkner. When my best friend from Wall revealed one night that she hadn't heard of John McEnroe or Jerry Garcia, some boys on the dormitory hall called us ignorant and white trash and chastised us for not reading magazines. We were hurt and surprised. White trash was something we said about other people at the Jersey Shore. My boyfriend from Wall accused me of going to Penn solely to find a boyfriend who drove a Ferrari, and the boys at Penn made fun of the Camaros we drove in high school. Class in America was not something we understood in any structural or intellectual way. Class was a constellation of a million little materialistic cultural signifiers, and the insult, loss, or acquisition of any of them could transform one's future entirely. In the end, I chose to pursue the new life Penn offered me. The kids I met had parents who were doctors or academics. Many of them had already even been to Europe. Penn, for all its superficiality, felt one step closer to a larger world. Still, I cannot remember any of us being conscious of foreign events during my 4 years of college. There were wars in Eritrea, Nepal, Afghanistan, Kosovo, East Timor, Kashmir. U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam were bombed. Panama, Nicaragua. I couldn't keep Latin American countries straight. Osama bin Laden, Clinton bombing Iraq. Nope. I knew Saddam Hussein, which had the same evil resonance as communism. I remember the movie Wag the Dog, a satire in which American politicians start a fake war with foreign terrorists to distract the electorate during a domestic scandal, which at the time was what many accused Clinton of doing when he ordered a missile strike on Afghanistan during the Monica Lewinsky affair. I never thought about Afghanistan. What country was in Wag the Dog? Albania. There was a typical American callousness in our reaction to the country they chose for the movie, an indifference that said, some bumblefuck country. It doesn't matter which one they choose. I was a child of the 90s, the decade when, according to America's foremost intellectuals, history had ended, the U.S. was triumphant, the Cold War won by a landslide. The historian David Schmitz has written that, by that time, the idea that America won because of its values and steadfast adherence to the promotion of liberalism and democracy was dominating op-ed pages, popular magazines, and the bestseller lists. These ideas were the ambient noise, the elevator music of my most formative years. But for me, there was also an intervention, a chance experience in the basement of Penn's library. I came across a line in a book in which a historian had argued that long ago, during the slavery era, black people and white people had defined their identities in opposition to each other. The revelation to me was not that black people had conceived of their identities in response to ours, but that our white identities had been composed in conscious objection to theirs. I'd had no idea that we had ever had to define our identities at all, because to me, white Americans were born fully formed, completely detached from any sort of complicated past. Even now, I can remember that shiver of recognition that only comes when you learn something that expands, just a tiny bit, your sense of reality. What made me angry was that this revelation was something about who I was. How much more did I not know about myself? It was because of this text that I picked up the books of James Baldwin, who gave me the sense of meeting someone who knew me better and with a far more sophisticated critical arsenal than I had myself. There was this line: "But I have always been struck, in America, by an emotional poverty so bottomless and a terror of human life, of human touch, so deep, that virtually no American appears able to achieve any viable, organic connection between his public stance and his private life." And this one: "All of the Western nations have been caught in a lie, the lie of their pretended humanism. This means that their history has no moral justification and that the West has no moral authority." And this one: "White Americans are probably the sickest and certainly the most dangerous people of any color to be found in the world today." I know why this came as a shock to me then, at the age of 22, and it wasn't necessarily because he said I was sick, though that was part of it. It was because he kept calling me that thing, white American. In my reaction, I justified his accusation. I knew I was white, and I knew I was American, but it was not what I understood to be my identity. For me, self-definition was about gender, personality, religion, education, dreams. I only thought about finding myself, becoming myself, discovering myself. And this, I hadn't known, was the most white American thing of all. I still did not think about my place in the larger world, or that perhaps an entire history, the history of white Americans, had something to do with who I was. My lack of consciousness allowed me to believe I was innocent, or that white American was not an identity like Muslim or Turk. Of this indifference, Baldwin wrote, "White children, in the main, and whether they are rich or poor, grow up with a grasp of reality so feeble that they can very accurately be described as deluded." Young white Americans, of course, go through pain, insecurity, and heartache. But it is very, very rare that young white Americans come across someone who tells them in harsh, unforgiving terms that they might merely be the easy winners of an ugly game, and indeed that because of their ignorance and misused power, they might be the losers within a greater moral universe.
This is The Guardian. This is The Guardian.
In 2007, after I'd worked for 6 years as a journalist in New York, I won a writing fellowship that would send me to Turkey for 2 years. I'd applied for it on a whim. No part of me expected to win the thing. Even as my friends wished me congratulations, I detected a look of concern on their faces, as if I was crazy to leave all this, as if 29 was a little too late to be finding myself. I'd never even been to Turkey before. In the weeks before my departure, I spent hours explaining Turkey's international relevance to my bored loved ones, no doubt deploying the cliché that Istanbul was the bridge between East and West. I told everyone that I chose Turkey because I wanted to learn about the Islamic world. The secret reason I wanted to go was that Baldwin had lived in Istanbul in the 1960s, on and off, for almost a decade. I had seen a documentary about Baldwin that said he had felt more comfortable as a black gay man in Istanbul than in Paris or New York. When I heard that, it made so little sense to me, sitting in my Brooklyn apartment, that a space opened in the universe. I couldn't believe that New York could be more illiberal than a place such as Turkey, because I couldn't conceive of how prejudiced New York and Paris had been in that era, and because I thought that as you went east, life degraded into the past, the opposite of progress. The idea of Baldwin in Turkey somehow placed America's race problem and America itself in a mysterious and tantalizing international context. I took a chance that Istanbul might be the place where the secret workings of history would be revealed. In Turkey and elsewhere, in fact, I would feel an almost physical sensation of intellectual and emotional discomfort while trying to grasp a reality of which I had no historical or cultural understanding. I would go, as a journalist, to write a story about Turkey or Greece or Egypt or Afghanistan, and inevitably someone would tell me some part of our shared history, theirs with America, of which I knew nothing. If I didn't know this history, then what kind of story did I plan to tell? My learning process abroad was threefold. I was learning about foreign countries, I was learning about America's role in the world, and I was also slowly understanding my own psychology, temperament, and prejudices. No matter how well I knew the predatory aspects of capitalism, I still perceived Turkey's and Greece's economic advances as progress, a kind of maturation. No matter how deeply I understood the U.S.'s manipulation of Egypt for its own foreign policy aims, I had never considered, and could not grasp, how American policies really affected the lives of individual Egyptians, beyond engendering resentment and anti-Americanism. No matter how much I believed that no American was well equipped for nation building, I thought I could see good intentions on the part of the Americans in Afghanistan. I would never have admitted it or thought to say it, but looking back, I know that deep in my consciousness, I thought that America was at the end of some evolutionary spectrum of civilization, and everyone else was trying to catch up. American exceptionalism did not only define the U.S. as a special nation among lesser nations, it also demanded that all Americans believe they too were somehow superior to others. How could I, as an American, understand a foreign people when unconsciously I did not extend the most basic faith to other people that I extended to myself? This was a limitation that was beyond racism, beyond prejudice, and beyond ignorance. This was a kind of nationalism so insidious that I had not known to call it nationalism. This was a self-delusion so complete that I could not see where it began and ended, could not root it out, could not destroy it. In my first few months in Istanbul, I lived a formless kind of existence, days dissolving into nights. I had no office to go to, no job to keep, and I was 30 years old, an age at which people either choose to grow up or remain stuck in the exploratory, idle phase of late, late youth. starting all over again in a foreign country. Making friends, learning a new language, trying to find your way through a city, meant almost certainly choosing the latter. I spent many nights out until the wee hours, such as the evening I drank beer with a young Turkish man named Emre, who had attended college with a friend of mine from the U.S. A friend had told me that Emre was one of the most brilliant people he had ever met. As the evening passed, I was gaining a lot from his analysis of Turkish politics, especially when I asked him whether he voted for Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, AKP, and he spat back outraged, "Did you vote for George W. Bush?" Up until that point, I had not realized that the two might be equivalent. Then, three beers in, Emre mentioned that the U.S. had planned the September 11th attacks. I'd heard this before. Conspiracy theories were common in Turkey. For example, when the military claimed that the PKK, the Kurdish militant group, had attacked a police station, some Turks believed the military itself had done it. They believed it even in cases where Turkish civilians had died. In other words, the idea was that right-wing forces, such as the military, bombed neutral targets or even right-wing targets, so they could then blame it on the left-wing groups, such as the PKK. To Turks, bombing one's own country seemed like a real possibility. "Come on, you don't believe that," I said. "Why not?" he snapped. "I do." "But it's a conspiracy theory." He laughed. "Americans always dismiss these things as conspiracy theories. It's the rest of the world who've had to deal with your conspiracies." I ignored him. "I guess I have faith in American journalism," I said. "Someone else would have figured this out if it were true." He smiled. "I'm sorry. There's no way they didn't have something to do with it. And now this war?" he said, referring to the war in Iraq. "It's impossible that the United States couldn't stop such a thing, and impossible that Muslims could pull it off." Some weeks later, a bomb went off in the Istanbul neighborhood of Gungoren. A second bomb exploded out of a garbage bin nearby after 10 p.m., killing 17 people and injuring 150. No one knew who did it. All that week, Turks debated, was it Al-Qaeda, the PKK, the DHKPC, a radical leftist group, or maybe the deep state? The deep state, a system of mafia-like paramilitary organizations operating outside of the law, sometimes at the behest of the official military, was a whole other story. Turks explained that the deep state had been formed during the Cold War as a way of countering communism, and then mutated into a force for destroying all threats to the Turkish state. The power that some Turks attributed to this entity sometimes strained credulity. But the point was that Turks had been living for years with the idea that some secret force controlled the fate of their nation. In fact, elements of the deep state were rumored to have had ties to the CIA during the Cold War. And though that too smacked of a conspiracy theory, this was the reality that Turkish people lived in. The sheer number of international interventions the U.S. launched in those decades is astonishing, especially during those years when American power was considered comparatively innocent. There were the successful assassinations, Patrice Lumumba, Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1961, General Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic, also in 1961, Ngo Dinh Diem, President of South Vietnam in 1963. There were the unsuccessful assassinations, Castro. There were the much-hoped-for assassinations, Nasser. And of course, U.S.-sponsored, supported, or staged regime changes. Iran, Guatemala, Iraq, Congo, Syria, Dominican Republic, South Vietnam, Indonesia, Brazil, Chile, Bolivia, Uruguay, and Argentina. The Americans trained or supported secret police forces everywhere from Cambodia to Colombia, the Philippines to Peru, Iran to Vietnam. Many Turks believed that the U.S. at least encouraged the 1971 and the 1980 military coups in Turkey, though I could find little about these events in any conventional histories anywhere. But what I could see was that the effects of such meddling were comparable to those of September 11th, just as huge, life-changing, and disruptive to the country and to people's lives. Perhaps Emre did not believe that September 11th was a straightforward affair of evidence and proof because his experience, his reality, taught him that very rarely were any of these surreally monumental events easily explainable. I did not think that Emre's theory about the attacks was plausible, but I began to wonder whether there was much difference between a foreigner's paranoia that the Americans planned September 11th and the Americans' paranoia that the whole world should pay for September 11th with an endless global war on terror. The next time a Turk told me she believed the U.S. had bombed itself on September 11th, I heard this with some regularity. This time it was from a young student at Istanbul's Boğaziçi University. I repeated my claim about believing in the integrity of American journalism. She replied, a bit sheepishly, "Well, right. We can't trust our journalism. We can't take that for granted." The words, "take that for granted," gave me pause. Having lived in Turkey for more than a year, witnessing how nationalistic propaganda had inspired people's views of the world and of themselves, I wondered from where the belief in our objectivity and rigor in journalism came. Why would Americans be objective and everyone else subjective? I thought that because Turkey had poorly functioning institutions, they didn't have a reliable justice system as compared to an American system I believed to be functional, it often felt as if there was no truth. Turks were always skeptical of official histories and blithely dismissive of the government's line. But was it rather that the Turks, with their beautiful skepticism, were actually just less nationalistic than me? American exceptionalism had declared my country unique in the world, the one truly free and modern country. And instead of ever considering that that exceptionalism was no different from any other country's nationalistic propaganda, I had internalized this belief. Wasn't that indeed what successful propaganda was supposed to do? I had not questioned the institution of American journalism outside of the standards it set for itself, which, after all, was the only way I would discern its flaws and prejudices. Instead, I accepted those standards as the best standards any country could possibly have. By the end of my first year abroad, I read U.S. newspapers differently. I could see how alienating they were to foreigners, the way articles spoke always from a position of American power, treating foreign countries as if they were America's misbehaving children. I listened to my compatriots with critical ears, the way our discussion of foreign policy had become infused since September 11th with these officious, official words, bureaucratic, corporate, military language, collateral damage, imminent threat, freedom, freedom, freedom. Even so, I was conscious that if I had long ago succumbed to the pathology of American nationalism, I wouldn't know it. Even if I understood the history of injustice in America, even if I was furious about the invasion of Iraq, I was a white American. I still had this fundamental faith in my country in a way that suddenly, in comparison to the Turks, made me feel immature and naive. I came to notice that a community of activists and intellectuals in Turkey, the liberal ones, were indeed questioning what Turkishness meant in new ways. Many of them had been brainwashed in their schools about their own history, about Atatürk, Turkey's first president, about the supposed evil of the Armenians and the Kurds and the Arabs, about the fragility of their borders and the rapaciousness of all outsiders, and about the historic and eternal goodness of the Turkish Republic. "It's different in the United States," I once said, not entirely realizing what I was saying until the words came out. I'd never been called upon to explain this. "We're told it is the greatest country on earth. The thing is, we will never reconsider that narrative the way you're doing just now, because to us, that isn't propaganda, that's truth. And to us, that isn't nationalism, it's patriotism. And the thing is, we will never question any of it, because at the same time, all we're being told is how free-thinking we are, that we're free. So we don't know there's anything wrong in believing our country is the greatest on earth. The whole thing sort of convinces you that a collective consciousness in the world came to that very conclusion." "Wow," a friend once replied. "How strange. That is a very quiet kind of fascism, isn't it?" It was a quiet kind of fascism that would mean I would always see Turkey as beneath the country I came from, and also that would mean I believed my uniquely benevolent country to have uniquely benevolent intentions toward the peoples of the world. During that night of conspiracy theories, Emre had alleged, as foreigners often did, that I was a spy. "The information that I was collecting as a journalist," Emre said, "was really being used for something else. As an American emissary in the wider world, writing about foreigners, governments, economies partaking in some larger system and scheme of things, I was an agent somehow." Emre lived in the American world as a foreigner, as someone less powerful, as someone for whom one newspaper article could mean war, or one misplaced opinion could mean an intervention by the International Monetary Fund. My attitude, my prejudice, my lack of generosity could be entirely false, inaccurate, or damaging, but would be taken for truth by the newspapers and magazines I wrote for, thus shaping perceptions of Turkey forever. Years later, an American journalist told me he loved working for a major newspaper because the White House read it, because he could influence policy. Emre had told me how likely it was I would screw this up. He was saying to me, "First, spy, do no harm."
For more Guardian long reads in text and a selection in audio, go to theguardian.com/longread or find us on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/theguardianlongread.
This is The Guardian.